Welcome to Practical Dermatology, the podcast. May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and the first Monday of every May is internationally recognized as Melanoma Monday. In honor of this, our panel of experts reveal the efforts they're making with their patients and suggest how to reduce the risk of skin cancer in certain populations. The most important tools at their disposal and the future of detection and treatment are also reviewed. Listen as they discuss their ideal multidisciplinary approach to treating patients with skin cancer.
Hi, this is Dr. Neil Bhatia. I'm Chief Medical Editor of Practical Dermatology, and I want to welcome you to this BMC podcast as we celebrate the month of May and Skin Cancer Awareness Month. And with me are three of my favorite dermatologists on the planet. I'm with Dr. Laura Ferris. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Dr. Ferris is at University of Pittsburgh. I'm with Dr. Vishal Patel. Vish, how are you?
Hi, Neil. Good to be here.
Dr. Patel is at George Washington University. And last and definitely not least is my good friend Todd Schlesinger from Charleston, South Carolina.
How are you doing, Neil? Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have all you guys. And I was going to just kick it off and talk a little bit about the month of May, skin cancer awareness, and some updates on skin cancer. And Laura, I'll start with you. How's your skin cancer awareness in the month of May going for all your patients?
Great. We're really enthusiastic about this. We have a Spot Me AAD skin cancer screening event planned later this month. Also, really here, we've had a big focus on trying to increase melanoma awareness and not just relying on skin cancer screening by dermatologists, but making sure that our patients are aware of the different presentations of melanoma and other skin cancers so that they can seek care quickly when they need it.
Are there strategies to increase awareness for skin cancer screenings, not just in the dermatology clinic, but even outside?
We have had the United States Preventive Services Task Force just released our updated guideline, the same thing, giving an I recommendation for insufficient evidence to recommend for or against skin cancer screening in asymptomatic low-risk individuals. What does that mean? We take every opportunity with our patients to try to provide information about melanoma. The AAD has great skin cancer awareness brochures. We try to make sure every patient, no matter what they come for, gets one of those to raise awareness. We look for opportunities to partner with organizations that provide education, such as some of our melanoma advocacy groups. We've also had a big focus on thinking about melanoma in our skin of color patients. So making sure that our patients are aware of different presentations. Also educating our peers in primary care, who often are the first people who come into contact with skin cancer patients, or maybe the patients who wouldn't normally come see a dermatologist may present there with skin cancer.
Now, I'm glad you brought up about skin of color. A lot of people don't remember that Bob Marley unfortunately passed from melanoma. So important for screening of all skin types as well as all surface areas, head to toe.
The anecdote about Bob Marley is actually one that I use regularly with our patients. We have a very large, diverse population in Washington, D.C. A lot of patients ask about screening and awareness in different populations. And I think it's good to separate out screening and awareness because those are two very important pieces of the public health campaign against the epidemic of skin cancer. Awareness is so critical for all different patient populations in understanding risk. I think what Laura has highlighted the AAD's campaign to really provide awareness and empower our patients is really so critical as that first step. And then also non-dermatologists. So we do a lot of work with educating our non-dermatologist colleagues because they can be the front line for many patients to provide awareness and provide that first triage moment of patients to get them filtered to the experts, to the dermatologists who have the training to identify what really needs to be evaluated more closely, potentially biopsied, et cetera, et cetera. As you noted, we have, under the leadership of Dr. Adam Friedman, our chair here at GW, we have a number of community outreach programs focused on the underserved population areas of DC that don't traditionally see a dermatologist to educate them about these important pieces. And that anecdote of Bob Marley goes a long way for people to understand why it can be important in patients of color. And then we have health services, Learn to Derm education services, as well as health campaigns where the Spot Me campaign is set up in our ward through Sunday church services to help educate patients and get them linked in. If they actually are worried about something, the awareness only goes so far. than having an output to provide screening if patients don't have that. So critical and so important in the month of May, but also all year round.
You bring up a good point too about starting out in your residency campaign, as well as getting the first 5 years out dermatologists to really get more involved also, which I think is, you know, pretty good testimonial to what you guys are doing there. Todd, I'll ask you, because, you know, you're heavily involved with the Academy and at the ASDS level, what kind of new initiatives are coming from those organizations, especially the Academy, who's, again, we see so many different programs between SpotMe and some of the other awareness campaigns on the websites.
It's nice to know about SpotMe. It's just been around since 85. During that process, they've detected almost 300,000 suspicious lesions on patients, and including more than 33,000 suspected melanoma. So it's a very successful campaign. We're also doing a SpotMe campaign screening later in the month. We partner in our private practice with a local community hospital or the large hospital system to do a community-wide skin cancer screening here in our community. A couple of things that AAD is also working on is there also is a website, which is called practicesafesun.org, and it's also a hashtag, which people can use in their social media to sort of share awareness as well, sort of impact that via social media channels. There is also another website called spotskincancer.org, which is a place where patients or individuals that have been affected by skin cancer can share personal stories. And that's another way to sort of get support and inspiration out there, because I think in some cases, coming from an individual who's actually been affected or afflicted by skin cancer, one to another can really help to raise awareness. We're running a couple of public service announcements locally in our area on the radio, where we partnered with a local radio personality to have a dialogue such as we're having here to raise awareness in the public.
I'm going to ask the three of you your opinions on two important tools that we have in the toolbox that may not be as commonly used. And one is the pigmented lesional assay, and the other is the 31 genome discussion, the 31 platform in the histopathology use for melanoma. I'm curious to hear how the three of you in different arenas would try to get dermatologists to at least understand the importance of incorporating these tools. So Laura, I know you're an investigator for all of these tools. Any thoughts on where do these two tools sit in the clinic and the path world, and what should we do to increase their utility?
In the clinic, the assay is the PLA, non-invasive tape sticker test that can be used to help us make smarter biopsy decisions. Where do we use this? It's certainly not replacing biopsy for me, but it's a tool. So if I have a patient who really doesn't want a biopsy, they're hesitant, but I'm worried about a lesion, or if I have a lesion that's in a very cosmetically sensitive area, and I'm worried about the scar that I might leave, it gives me another piece of information to help me avoid biopsies that may be higher risk or very undesirable for that patient. I think it's helpful in as a way to avoid biopsies. It's not something I'm using to go try on every benign looking mole to say, could this possibly be melanoma? But really trying to focus on if I think it needs a biopsy, but I've got a compelling reason not to, using it in that setting.
What about you, Michelle? What would you say in the current state of derm practice? Where does the pigmented lesional assay fit?
It's important to be thoughtful, and these are powerful tools. Support tools. And that's what we tell our trainees, and when I speak to other physicians, my thought process around these tools and for all dermatologists to realize is just like with any other technology, we see a slow transition to hopefully more intelligent, more accurate support tools for all parts of our life, whether you call it artificial intelligence, machine learning, or digital tools for pigmented lesion diagnosis or risk stratification and prediction on behavior of known melanomas. These are really powerful tools that are really going to help our practice. I've always used this analogy that we've moved from an analog to a more digital world for all of medicine. That certainly is happening in dermatology. We are experts of the skin, but our expertise, it's important to be humble that we're only as good as however many lesions we've seen, or not everybody can be Ash Margoop with the dermatoscope, our good friend who's such a world-renowned expert and can pick up even the smallest little changes in a lesion. I certainly cannot, but I think dermatologists who are seeing so many lesions are trained to do so. But being humble and knowing where our limitations are is where we can incorporate these very powerful tools. That being said, it's important for dermatologists to begin to become familiar with how these tools have come to be, because understanding the algorithms and the input, the data sets that have gone in to create these artificial intelligence or gene expression profiling algorithms are so critical so that we know how to most appropriately use them. When you know that you have a pigmented lesion, this can help you decide whether you feel like you need to biopsy or not, but it's not replacing your clinical judgment. The pigmented lesion assay may not be as accurate because it's been tested and validated on pigmented lesions. Without getting into the weeds, it's just important for us to realize what we're using the tool for rather than just indiscriminately applying it. And I think that highlights when people say, well, is this going to replace a dermatologist? No, absolutely not. It will strengthen the role of the dermatologist to be able to provide that filter and then to appropriately utilize this. Same thing with the 31 gene expression profiling test for melanoma, being able to understand what we're going to get out of that result and which patients will benefit. If a patient has a thin melanoma and potentially may create more anxiety and they're not a candidate for other therapy as a result for it, I sometimes pause and think about what am I going to get out of this test and have that discussion with the patient. But I really do believe that in 5 years, this is going to make us so much stronger and better advocates for our patients and help us close that gap between suspicion and confidence in both the diagnosis and behavior of a pigmented lesion.
You both hit on two real important points, especially the term unnecessary, which I remember was one of the things brought out early on when those two tests were introduced to our world. And they said, well, why would we do this to avoid unnecessary biopsies? And same thing with the genomics test, to say, well, this is all unnecessary testing. And yet you think about the outcomes for the patients that have either led to more precise surgical techniques for the right, you know, neoplasm, or even more so the diagnostics that led to better outcomes for those melanoma patients. I think this is where, again, the awareness has to be brought on, not just by us, because industry can't really talk too much about the things that we need them to hear. But I think we need to get into our colleagues' heads that say, look, we are here to do what's best for the specialty and the growth of our specialty, as well as the awareness to the patients. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the therapies we have in our toolbox that are underutilized. And specifically, I want to talk about hedgehog inhibitors, why these drugs not only are safe, but they really have a strong role in an adjunctive space in treating skin cancer.
Hedgehog pathway inhibitors, we know we have two with sonitogeb and vismodogeb. Both have been approved now for a good while to treat locally advanced and metastatic basal cell carcinoma. They've been coming more and more in widespread use. And why should we use them? I mean, they're both approved, not as really adjuvant therapy. They're approved as primary therapy for the advanced tumor, but they become in widespread use as adjuvant therapy, of course, or neoadjuvant therapy, you know, used before surgery. So both of these are oral medications that are given oftentimes over a long period of time. And I think that's something that's important to understand. I think the fear that has come from the use of these medications has been adverse effect management. Over time, we've become better and better at being able to manage the side effects from both of these medications, which are very similar. Sonitogeb has a little bit of drug interactions to be aware of. Vismodogeb, not as many. Data is similar, you know, if you look at both of the studies. But what's nice about these two drugs is they seem to work in practice better than advertised in the clinical studies as far as treating these advanced tumors. They have also come to use as intermittent dosing has been very helpful to help manage these adverse events, but it's also important. And the adverse event profile is usually going to be headaches, nausea, neuropathy, things like that are the more common ones, alopecia or hair loss. But the long-term studies that were done with vismodogeb, one was called the Stevie study, and it was a global safety study, showed us that over time, the adverse effects become less prominent as patients are staying on these medications longer. It is important to recognize that these can be long-term therapies, or they sometimes need to be long-term therapies because not necessarily, especially for patients like basal cell nevus syndrome, patients who have multiple, it's going to be a long-term therapy for them. For patients who have locally advanced tumors, that can be shrunk down to something that's surgically managed, that can be very helpful as well. I think it's important for dermatologists to sort of take a good look at these medicines, see how they can sort of fit into their patient profiles, have that discussion with their patients that these medications are available, but also be aware that there are some issues with them, including resistance. So you may find that some tumors don't respond. There may be multiple reasons for that. There could be mutations sort of along the pathway that may prevent some patients or some tumors from responding. So it's important to be aware of the resistance profiles. There's definitely a lot of research going on in that world and to look at that. So, you know, I think as we learn more, educate ourselves more, dermatologists should become more comfortable using these medications and try to reduce the level of anxiety that comes around using them, because they actually generally are well tolerated by most patients. And when there are tumors that are, not amenable to surgery or radiation, or you're looking for some alternative, and then at least for the basal cell carcinoma patients, that these can be considered. And so hopefully we'll see in a more widespread use, and also in combination with other treatments.
Obviously, industry is not going to be able to tell us, use it with surgery, use it as a precursor to Mohs, use it after. It really comes from us to determine a regimen that makes sense. But you think about all those patients who may not have access to Mohs, who've got bad eyelid tumors, who've got just solid tumors that are just fungating and need, some sort of shrinkage. Laura, who is the hedgehog inhibitor patient?
These are patients who I usually bring and discuss at our multidisciplinary tumor board. So that's really helpful, because I'm not a Mohs surgeon. So I want to not just be the one making the decision of what's inoperable. So one, it's done as a group, but two, it really takes into account a lot of things. So one, where is that tumor located? So the most recent patient who I had a tumor that was right along starting to involve the lower eyelid margin. So that was really an important consideration. It wasn't the size of the tumor. It was big, but it was also the location of that tumor. Two, it's also the individual. So it's the person who will versus will not tolerate surgery. So it's really done in discussion with my surgical and medical oncology colleagues, and in discussion with the patient. And really, I think one of my most important roles as the dermatologist is I'm often the person who has the longest term relationship with that patient. So knowing the patient, knowing who you're going to be able to work through some of the side effects with, knowing who's going to be good at following up, knowing who's going to tolerate a surgery, and maybe who won't tolerate a surgery that might be manageable for some patients.
The collaboration with oncologists definitely helps in many respects, especially in an institution. Those of us who are out in the field alone often don't have the access to that help. But I do think it helps not only with some of the management, as well as even getting some of the drugs covered. But at the same time, we don't want to lose our grip on these patients. I mean, the skin cancer patients are still ours. And, a lot of times we hear about the trials being directed by oncologists or some of the other components of the management going away from us. And we don't want that to slip away. Michelle, I'll ask you about three of your favorite letters, which are PDT. And photodynamic therapy being both red and blue. Same question I'll pose to you. Who is your PDT patient in this day and age? And why are we not seeing more uptake of PDT among our colleagues, both for AKs and skin cancer?
I think all field cancerization treatments I'm a big fan of, but I think PDT is so versatile. In the last few years, I've almost had a renaissance in my mind of thinking about all of the potential applications for PDT. And it includes both from a dermatologic oncology standpoint, but even inflammatory and other types of disease processes. I'm thinking of PDT for more patients now than I think I traditionally thought of when I was shortly out of training. You highlighted a point with the hedgehog inhibitors that when you're out in the community further away from an academic university and have multidisciplinary input, it's so critical to think about all the pieces that Laura outlined for the patient. And think about all the potential options. Hedgehogs makes a lot of sense, as a surgeon for me to potentially postpone surgery if we're on the fence about doing surgery. It doesn't take it off the table. PDT to me is very similar in that it can treat a wide variety of potential conditions. And I'm beginning to use it and even favor it much earlier on than I think we traditionally think of PDT as for a higher burden of disease. It's become my favorite for some of the younger patients because we want mild rejuvenative effects, as well as treating some of the subclinical disease, both from a field actinic damage standpoint or those really early onset precursor just early budding superficial basal cells that we know from European data is a first line approach for some of those thin tumors before they've even come to the surface and been biopsied. So I'm thinking about from an epidemiologic standpoint or a public health standpoint, is this like a straddling of primary and secondary prevention at the same time? I tell patients with all different ranges of skin cancer treatment is like going to the gym, exercising for the gym. We're all at different energy levels and strength levels, whether you're the 65-year-old Ironman worker that I look at and say, I have no idea how somebody could do that. And I feel sore just by looking at some of my patients who do that at 65 and 70. Or you're the 20-year-old college athlete who is very active and at the gym pumping iron. We're all at different levels, and PDT is the additive exercise.
The thing that bothered me the most about the latest AK guidelines were PDT did not get as high of marks of recommendation as they should, nor do we want that to dissuade anyone, especially in the first 5 years out, just starting to get involved with photodynamic therapy, whether they choose red light, blue light. I don't think there's a better chemo prevention model we have than sequential PDT models.
I think that you've highlighted that very nicely. It didn't get the respect that I think it's due. I think it's important for dermatologists to highlight. I certainly think of PDT is our core tool that we can utilize. But especially so when we think about the intersection of an energy-based device, a topical treatment, and as you said, skin cancer, I mean, PDT is that triumvirate. And so important to a dermatologist who's treating and seeing all patients, that to me, this is one of the earliest things that you should invest in and utilize for a wide range of patients in your practice. And I certainly do.
Yeah. Well, that's important. And even too, in this new model of dermatology with consolidation, I mean, this is actually an even better time to get PDT involved with the system, because that's something that every dermatologist can rotate through and you know, treat much more, many more patients with that opportunity. Your take on checkpoint inhibitors in dermatology, and should we be afraid of those, and how do we get more involved in using checkpoint inhibitors in some of these, you know, nasty squames and basal cells as well as Merkel cell?
How important it is to involve the multidisciplinary team when you're thinking about using this types of medications. So these are IV infusions that are given for advanced squamous cell and advanced basal cell carcinoma. So now I'm in private practice, so and I've had, you know, was on the studies for these medications and infused them myself. But most dermatologists, I'd say vast majority of dermatologists, are not going to be infusing these medications in their practice. Although it's not something that we can't do. You just have to be properly set up for it. Most of the time it's going to be infused at the oncologist office just because they're set up to do that kind of thing. The other thing to be aware of when you're talking about checkpoint inhibitor medications is that the adverse event management is important. Again, most patients tolerate well, but there's a few that can have more serious side effects. So the most important thing to be aware of is that they need to be managed early. I think we're on an upswing as just educating dermatologists that these medications are there, what the utility is, and that to think of them in those patient discussions where you have more advanced skin cancers that might be amenable to surgery or radiation, to at least bring those up with your patients, bring that into the conversation with that multidisciplinary team in the community.
The biggest point is just staying involved, right? Identifying the right candidate, you know, making sure they're walking through the steps, and, you know, making sure that they're contacting you after each infusion, how are things going, and then setting up the long-term management plan.
Yeah. One real key point that's very important, Neil, and that's just to say, if you have patients that are actually getting those infusions at other offices, your front staff should be highly aware that patients may call in with sort of unusual symptoms like cough, diarrhea, go to primary care. So they need to be aware that these patients are coming from your office getting infusions, maybe elsewhere. They may call your office with those adverse events. They need to let the doctor know. It's not the patient that you send off to the you know, urgent care from the call center.
They should get the golden pass to say, hey, you know, got something I got to talk to you about real fast. I'll give each of you just a word association or a summary of skin cancer.
I think the key factor is that as dermatologists, we're really the front line of skin cancer. We find skin cancers at the most curable stage, but we're an important part of the team. We need to know what's going on with advanced therapy, even if we're not giving it, because we need to introduce the idea to patients. We need to be able to direct them to the right providers, whether that's surgical oncology or it's medical oncology, or if we're prescribing those drugs ourselves. But there's lots of great options, and skin cancer isn't as bad of a diagnosis as it used to be.
I'm going to piggyback on that and agree with Laura and go one step further and say the world of advanced skin cancer management is moving so rapidly. We think about, it took a decade in melanoma for all these, the holy grails to come to be. And then it moved in a matter of just a few years to squamous cell carcinoma, basal cell carcinoma with checkpoint inhibition. I think we're going to see, and we already know that it's in the works for some of these treatments to be moved into an being investigated as an interlesional treatment. We certainly know that dermatologists are the expert for how to provide that. But also there's been recent publications about utilizing checkpoint inhibition in the larger tumors that are resectable and having pathologic cures with just a few treatments of checkpoint inhibition and still having surgery to confirm that. And we will hopefully have data that shows that really impacts the lives of these patients with those bad tumors that are not quite going to the head and neck surgeon, but maybe some of our MOs and dermatologic oncologists who are out in the community are seeing routinely. And so being comfortable with this and starting to incorporate that is going to be really critical. And the next 2 years, I think that you're going to see an explosion of how that incorporates into dermatology, as well as the adverse effects that Todd talked about and the importance of the supportive dermato-oncologist role of all those side effects.
Todd, go ahead and finish this up.
I think there's so much more to come, seeing research in PDT for basal cell carcinoma, seeing also the intralesional, and then also coming on the horizon for a little bit less invasive tumors, you know, more the superficial ones that you might have surgery for. We're starting to see some new energy-based treatments coming online for those and the research side, not approved yet, but coming around the research side. So ways we can handle the mild to moderate basal cell carcinoma with non-surgical, maybe energy-based treatments. So pulse electrical energy is coming, hopefully.
So this was a nice podcast from BMC. This was Dr. Neil Bhatia with my friends Dr. Laura Ferris, Dr. Vishal Patel, Dr. Todd Schlesinger. And thanks for staying in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Dermatology, the podcast. You can find future editions at practicaldermatology.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.